It's a pleasure to be here sharing some thoughts with you today. So a little bit about myself. I am actually a clinician. I practice emergency medicine. I'm a health services researcher. So in that sense, I try to understand how the healthcare system operates and how we deliver healthcare. And I also wear the hat of a bioethicist. So I like to think about what we're doing in an applied sense, but what the philosophical or theoretical understandings of how to act inform that. So today I want to talk to you a little bit about religious values and healthcare accommodations, particularly from the perspective of the Muslim American Muslim community, and I also have no financial relationships disclosed. So in particular, my work lies at this interface, at one level between the patient and the provider. So I'm interested in how Islam, and this is from American Muslims, influences how patients act outside the healthcare system, in the way that they do things to maintain their health, and in the healthcare system, how they interact with the healthcare and healthcare-seeking behaviors. I'm interested in how Islam informs providers, so how understandings of their faith inform how Muslim providers act in the healthcare encounter. And for both of these populations, how Islam as an ethical tradition informs their bioethical decision making. At the level of the Muslim community and the healthcare system, I'm interested in how we adapt to meet community needs, right? In this case, the American Muslim community needs. So in particular, who we accommodate, and by that I mean what values we accommodate in the healthcare encounter. Well, how do we, and then how we do so? How do we adapt, and to what extent? How far are we willing to go to change the built structure of the hospital environment or the way we interact with patients to meet their needs? Oh, wrong way. So this interface right here has a lot of implications, right, in terms of quality of care. So we know that stable patient-provider alliances lead to better healthcare outcomes. We know that that improves patient satisfaction, and that the interaction at the healthcare system, what we call healthcare disparities, obviously play a role in health differences outside of the population, right? It's one big circle. Healthcare is just one piece of health differences between populations. So, this is going the wrong way. The American Muslim population is demographically diverse, about 7 million Muslims in the United States. We think about a quarter of them are indigenous African Americans, another quarter almost are South Asian Americans, and another quarter are Arab American. So these are the large three communities within that larger 7 million community. They have varied immigration histories. So although two-thirds of them are immigrants, one-third are native-born. And they each of these larger three communities have their own history. So in some studies, as much as one of five people who came over the slave trade were actually initially Muslim. They lost that tradition, but then they had a period where they reclaimed that tradition. We also have Arab Americans and South Asian Americans who came Arabs before South Asians in the 19th century. Why we think about Detroit is that Henry Ford and the building industrial complex, he wanted to have lighter-skinned people who are technically able to come and fulfill that workforce. So they actually recruited people from the Middle East who were highly trained. And then the South Asians came in the 20th century as skilled laborers as well in the industrial complex and also in the healthcare system. So what is known about American Muslim health in general? Right? That's the background to what I'm going to talk about specifically the project later on. The answer is not much. So when I started this work about 3 years ago, I wanted to understand what has been investigated about American Muslim health as this geographically diverse, you know, racially diverse community. So we conducted a systematic Medline review looking at American Muslims in particular as an ethnic group, and then trying to add on immigrant populations that we knew would be Muslim to increase the capture within that systematic review. We found from 3,000 papers about 171 dealt with these populations, of which the majority studied Arab Americans or South Asians, so 42 and 41. The interesting thing to note is that these are not solely Muslim populations, right? So 50% of Arabs in the United States are not Muslim, and South Asians include Bangladeshi, Indians, and also Pakistanis. You know, although Bangladeshis and Pakistanis are predominantly Muslims, Indians aren't, right? They're a minority. So you can't get at religion through that perspective. And of those 171, only 29 mentioned Islam at all, anywhere in the text of the study. So you're studying a population, right, for healthcare disparities, and you're not assessing at all whether they have a religious tradition. And of those that did, 19 studies looked at Islam. They considered Islam to play some role in health differences. So again, you can't generalize from 19 studies empirically investigated, right? People have, there are a lot of studies about the provider's perspectives on taking care of the Muslim patient, but they haven't done any population-based studies to get that assessment. So what do we really know? We know some things. So from this large literature review, we know that Islam does give meaning to health and disease for some populations. There are studies around, for example, pregnancy, and some Muslim populations consider this to be a blessing. therefore, the implication for the healthcare side is that they're not in favor of contraceptive practices. Or other populations noted that cancer is a disease of fate, right? Therefore, prevention of cancer might not be a priority, or that's at least how the healthcare providers saw it. Islam informs the way that you interact with the healthcare system and also the things you do to maintain your health. So for example, if people are religious and they follow the Islamic code of not drinking alcohol, that population therefore might have reduced consumption, therefore reduced alcohol-related morbidities. Or in this case, as I'm going to expound on a little later, if you believe your social values have this regulation of interaction between the sexes, right? So you want to have gender concordant providers. If you're not going to have those providers, that might influence your healthcare seeking patterns. Lastly, this piece I'm not going to touch a lot on, but this is some of my initial work was on this piece about Islam as identity. So in the post 9/11 environment, people who are Muslim or deemed to be Muslim have been discriminated against. We've talked about, I think the recent studies showed that levels before 9/11 increased right after 9/11, the first 2 years, but those levels still, discrimination and abuse, are higher than they were pre-9/11 for Muslim populations. This is the social climate and environment we live in. And that one of the studies that we did that was population-based showed that this has had a clear impact upon the psychological health of the Arab American community in Detroit. That was background now to this particular study that I'm going to share some insights with you about. So we conducted a community-based participatory research project in Southeast Michigan with an American Muslim policy think tank, the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding, two organizations here that represent mosques, and then a community health organization. And the research was conducted in two phases over 18 months. The first phase was semi-structured interviews with community leaders identified by a community advisory group, and then we used that to form the basis for focus groups at mosques that were according to the three different larger populations, Arab American, South Asian American, and indigenous African American. The project was funded largely by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and we chose Detroit because it has a good number of these people there, right? So we do know that about 200,000 Muslims live in that area. These are actually from 1995 data, so it probably increased. And we know that Detroit's known for having the largest concentration of Arab Americans outside of the Middle East, right? So about 500,000. And again, as I said, only 50% of them might be Muslims. So the project aimed to look at Islam-related health beliefs and how those beliefs influence healthcare patterns. And we sampled, as I mentioned before, I'm going to skip over these slides, but we can get to them if you want in the question and answer session. We sampled based on trying to get equal numbers of demographics of South Asian, African American, and some Arabs. 102 people ultimately participated. And so one of the major outcomes of this for the community side was a policy report that was published in June entitled Meeting the Healthcare Needs of American Muslims. There are some copies in the back. You're free to take those if you'd like. But if you want to email me, I can send you a PDF as well. And for us on the academic side, a series of papers have come out documenting various issues within the community. Today, we're going to talk about healthcare accommodations. Okay, so what are healthcare accommodations? We define these things as structural changes within the healthcare environment or the encounter to meet a patient need, right? Based on their cultural or religious value. So at the end of our focus groups, we had discussion in each of these focus groups about specifically what changes would they, the participants, like to see in the hospital to make them feel more comfortable as Muslims. And looking at these focus groups, we generated some lists. There was some discussion around each item. And when we did the analysis, we found these three things to be the dominant themes. One was gender concordant care. The second was halal food. And the last was neutral space for prayer. So not all the way unexpected, but this is actually from the community, right? As opposed to a provider telling you this is what we need. This is people telling us this is what we need. This is what we prioritize. So gender concordance, and we've largely heard about this in many different venues, and even Mark touched on this, but the idea that this comes from understandings of just modesty, privacy, and comfort. This is understandable. But actually, what sometimes we neglect because of our lens is that this is an integral part of the religious ethical code. Right? This has a religious significance for patients who are Muslim. And we spent some time looking at that. So a colleague of mine and I went through the religious texts and used the Islamic ethical legal framework, right? The religious texts and the interpreters of those texts, and tried to understand how this social regulation of interaction between the sexes plays a role in healthcare. And we identified three different areas, which I'm going to share with you very briefly, but this is drawn from the text, right, itself. So the first thing was that Islamic bioethics does talk about a physician's choice hierarchy. That if all else is equal, taking that assumption that Muslims should choose, right, a physician who's Muslim and of the same gender. And if you don't have that, then a non-Muslim of the same gender. If you don't have that, then Muslim of opposite gender, and then non-Muslim of the opposite gender. So here, the gender is prioritized over religion. And the reason is that it's believed that people will be more forthcoming when they're dealing with a provider of the same sex. Right? So if there is a body part to be examined, there's some health issue that they want to discuss, that in that environment, it's a safe environment to talk about these things. That's the assumption. So even if the person is not Muslim, you should try to seek out a non-Muslim of the same gender. But the issue of trying to get providers who are of the same faith has to do with religious obligations. So Muslim physicians are in this sort of expected to know about their religion as well as about medicine. So for example, if a patient has to fast, right, in the month of Ramadan, when can you not fast? Well, you don't have to fast if you're sick. Who is the person who's going to decide upon that? It's supposed to be the Muslim physician. Even if you look at in fatawa and religious writings of scholars, they say ask a Muslim physician of good character, because they're the ones who know about the body, right? So this is why if patients are told to try to choose a physician of the same religion. Another area was around seclusion. So the idea that unrelated members of the opposite sex should not be in an area enclosed by themselves to keep off accusations and also to reduce the chances of having illicit relations. But in the healthcare environment, this is easily broken, right? So by having a curtain, we use curtains all the time, or by having doors slightly ajar. The idea is that seclusion has to be potential, right? So if someone potentially can hear what's going on and see what's going on, then that means seclusion doesn't exist. Lastly, this idea of physical contact. Again, highly regulated, the idea that you shouldn't be interacting with people in a physical realm unless you need to, right? So members of the opposite sex shouldn't be having relations who are not related. Some scholars say this is all time. Some people say this is only when there's some chance for sexual desire or temptation. But in any case, that's the religious text. People interpret that, right? And so now that you know the background, you'll understand why these were the quotes that we received during our study. A Muslim woman shared with us, "I don't want a male in here," talking about her room, her hospital room. "I'm all exposed." She felt that she was always exposed. She just didn't want males entering that room. Or a Muslim male talked about his experience in a hospital, that one of my issues was having clothing. I want to have clothing, gowns that cover us, right? I don't want to be seen as half-clothed. And this is a male. We spoke about gender-concordant care, and we know that this, out of all, in the report we talk about this at length, that out of all the things that they talked about, this was one of the key things that influenced healthcare choices and patterning of healthcare behavior. So the gender issue is really high on my list. It's not necessary that the doctor be Muslim, but they have to be female. Or I would not even walk into the clinic if I didn't have a choice of gender. So this was in the minds of patients trying to interact with the healthcare system. Now, after all that, your sickness is a time when you're tried in many ways, right? Through your own body, through interactions. If you have to stay in the hospital, that's difficult. If you have to be at a rehab facility, that's difficult. A lot of things are happening and you're not in control. When you ask them what they remember of their illness, this gets you to think about what patients feel and what they leave with. So in terms of a clinical encounter, a patient shared with us this idea. She went to the emergency department, had to be examined by a male. And what she remembered was not the fact that she was bleeding or had something else, but she remembered that, "I wish the ground would have swallowed me up," when she was being examined by the male physician. Or a Turkish patient who had suffered a stroke was in a rehab facility for months. And in a rehab facility, you don't have control over your food. You know, he was somewhat paralyzed. You couldn't do a lot of things. But for him, the thing that he remembered of that stay for months was the daily humiliation of being washed by a woman. And he couldn't do anything about that. So he said, "The worst thing for me was being washed by a woman every morning." This repeated sort of value system that was being compromised. I'm getting to the end here. So now, halal food, and halal food is food that is religiously prescribed. So Muslims don't eat pork, and they don't drink alcohol. But also, the way that we slaughter animals for consumption has some regulations similar to kosher, but different and less stringent. So people say, well, this is religiously prescribed, therefore having halal food is important. That's got to be the best food source. But what was key about this was the absence during that convalescent period. So while everybody agrees nutrition is a major part of a healing, but all I get is vegetarian. Right? Every time they ask, I ask for halal food, I get vegetarian. I mean, everybody gets meat except for us. So this was seen as a potential problem. As Mark will discuss a little later, but he also gave you an inkling to this, prayer is an important part of people's experience and how they deal with illness. So we realize that prayer in different forms for people has spiritual meaning, but also they believe has some healing quality. So prayer room is a form of healing on its own. But what participants share with us in this post 9/11 environment was the social repercussions of not having a prayer area, right? So I'm not going to go into this quote, but there was a setting. They described a story where there were people visiting a family member in the hospital. They started to pray. People started gawking at them, right, and looking at what's going on. Is everything okay? Security is called. And then after that, the healthcare workers didn't feel comfortable going to that room. So how did that patient feel or that family feel afterwards? Right, that is the question for us. So moving from the trees to the forest. As Mark will expound upon, our patients shared with us that the healthcare providers should be respectful and take stock of their religious values. That this is expected now. We should have some sensitivity to patients' religion. And they felt that that some providers didn't go to that distance with them, to that length with them. So I don't know what's about some of them, but it seems like they're so above you. Or this idea of assumption, you know, I do understand in medical education, you talk about don't assume, and you should always ask, but certain things you should know about, right? And Muslim patients felt that, you know, it's not as if I'm the patient, I have to say, pay attention, I'm a Muslim woman, I have this modesty issue. There should be some modicum of understanding people have to be sensitive around that. Moving on, they felt specifically discriminated against in a certain way because other communities have these sorts of accommodations. So why not Muslim patients? Why don't we go the extra mile with Muslims? Their needs are tiny, what's the big deal? And the question was asked in Southeast Michigan, right, where there are a lot of Muslim patients, not in some small community in Maine, which actually went and changed the way they do things. So the idea is that healthcare accommodations would increase respect and trust. When the nurse tells you, I respect your religion, I have trusted her. That's half the work of being a healthcare giver. So let me leave you with a couple of thoughts that I hopefully won't confuse you. So why don't we have accommodations in the healthcare environment? Well, you know, from the patient side, they might feel that this is a post 9/11 environment creeping into the healthcare encounter, and therefore they don't want to speak about being Muslim. They're fearful of being discriminated against, and we have some empirical studies that talk about decreased self-identification of Muslims post 9/11 in the hospital. The other thing from the healthcare system side might be that we feel, as healthcare providers and administration, that we already have established services. We have food services, we have prayer areas. So they should be able to meet a large section of the population's needs already, that we don't have to kind of tailor it to specific religious communities. So as a researcher, when I think about what the community shared with me during our study, there are some opportunities for empirical research. Right? So does this issue of lack of gender concordance influence breast cancer screening behaviors in the community? Is there an increased burden of disease or less screening because of this gender concordance value? Or does discrimination in the hospital system lead to differential healthcare-seeking behaviors, some hospitals, not others? Or if you have halal food in some hospitals, do we go there preferentially compared to other hospitals? And as a bioethicist, then we think about, well, what is the just allocation of resources for cultural modifications in healthcare? What level do we have to reach, and what do we have to document to say that we should change the way we do things, right? And then we should resource allocate for that. When do we make that trade-off? If we know a community, in this case, might have lower screening rates for breast cancer because of a gender concordance issue, do we then create a clinic around same-sex mammography? Do we do that? And it's not something that we think about accommodating just particular groups, right? Sometimes when you move something from one group, it uncovers something that's affecting a lot of people, right? So this gender thing is not necessarily religiously based. A lot of people feel the same way. But how are we going to do that, and what resources will we bring to bear? So lastly, the study that we did was in Southeast Michigan, so obviously it won't be generalizable to other communities, particularly those that are less religious potentially or smaller. And I just want to leave with this slide that this work was not done by myself. My project manager is sitting back there, Amal Kalawi, and we had an incredible academic team as well as the community partners in this work. Thank you.
Thank you.